This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It was the best of times, and then, very shortly thereafter, the worst of times this week for London, which on Wednesday was awarded the 2012 Summer Olympics. That announcement triggered mass jubilation for some reason, but on Thursday, central London suffered a series of bombings, leading to speculation about security in the short term and at the Olympics 7 years from now. Joining me now on the line from London to help us gauge the mood of that city and to forecast what happens next in regard to the 2012 Games is Sean Ingle of The Guardian newspaper. Sean, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. Nice speaking to you.
On Thursday, Britain's Culture Secretary Tessa Joel said that it would be, quote, completely inappropriate to go ahead with events to celebrate the winning bid. What's the mood in the city like now?
I think, to be honest, the mood is still one of defiance. I think Londoners are they're used to these sort of things happening. We had the IRA bombing us for 20, 30 years. This has obviously been a huge shock, but it's not something that was completely unexpected. With Britain having supported, you know, America with Iraq, you know, London's a big international city. We expected at some point that we would be a target, and so we were.
Was there a sense at all that the Olympic bid, winning the Olympic bid, was at all involved in this? Are people talking about it in that way?
I don't think so. It's amazing how quickly the euphoria of the Olympic bid has completely dissipated. I think people are talking about maybe it was because the G8 summit in Scotland. Was probably it was an obvious target point because a lot of the Scotland Yard detectives were up in Scotland looking after the world leaders and the dignitaries, so we're a little bit short on the ground in London. But, I mean, with the underground and there's no security checks. It's not like when you fly on a plane that you go through passport control and you have your bag scanned, and then the tube's obviously a very easy target.
In part due to spiraling security costs for the 2004 Games, Greece is now facing a nationwide budget crisis. London organizers had only planned to spend about a third of what Greece spent on security. Should organizers now rethink those costs and perhaps the larger question of whether the Games are worth the price?
I think it's probably too soon for those discussions, but I think, next few years, that will be talked about. It is, frankly, incredibly easy for, if I wanted to plant a bomb on the tube, I'm sure it wouldn't be difficult, because there are, as I said earlier, there are no scanning devices. It's very easy, and that might have to change. They promised us that the cost would be very minor. I think it's something like 28p per person per year over the next few years, something ridiculously. But so it's not a political issue here at the moment. Obviously, if we have more attacks in different cities over the next few years, that might have to change.
As hard as it is to imagine at the moment, London is now in the process of preparing for an Olympic Games. This was not the expected outcome from the IOC vote in Singapore. How did that result come to be?
Well, I think some of us here are still scratching our heads with disbelief. I think there's a couple of things. First of all, Paris were favourites, and I think, favourites in any situation, the temptation is to take it easy, play it safe, hold on to what you have. London, a year ago were complete outsiders. When the IOC, did its evaluation report in May 2004, they called the city's transport system obsolete, and they questioned the level of political and public support. I think what changed, we had Seb Coe, who's a two-time gold medalist, he took over, and I think because London were outsiders, they were able to take risks. They sent David Beckham, who's to meet and greet the delegates. They gave them the vision thing to use what Bill Clinton would say. They told them that there was a whole area of East London that hadn't been regenerated for 100, 200 years, and that would they would leave a legacy. And I think a lot of IOC delegates like the idea that when they when the Olympics has come and gone, there'll be a transport system in that part of London. There'll be stadiums. There'll be housing for ordinary workers. I think that played well. I think the other thing was as well, they were quite clever politically. They sort of had an unofficial alliance with Madrid, almost saying to Madrid, well, if you get knocked out in the third round, we'll tell our delegate, the people who are going to support us to support you instead, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that made a difference too.
Still, all the celebrities you've mentioned and all the excellent politicking you've mentioned aside, were Londoners surprised to have won?
I think they were. A week or so ago, Paris were 3-1 on favourites, with London sort of being 3-1 outsiders. But over the last week, those odds have come down. I think most people here, most professional sports journalists thought, well, that's just a consequence of patriotic punters putting their money, sort of hope rather than expectation. There was that sense that London would offer something that Paris wouldn't. You know, Paris had the infrastructure in place already. You know, their legacy wouldn't have been as strong. Well, London sort of basically gave the IOC a vision. Really, most of what's there is just on architecture boards at the moment. There's obviously a few old stadiums. Most of what's going to be developed is, you know, hasn't been built yet, and yet that seemed to, you know, that seemed to play.
Some of those involved with building venues for the 2012 games may have been relieved they don't have to build a baseball stadium or a softball stadium. Those sports have been eliminated. So are Brits backing rugby, golf? What replacement would be the best on their minds?
Well, I think, you know, the ideal replacement would be darts.
Darts! Excellent.
We seem to win. We have a guy called Phil the Power Taylor in this country who's won all the world championships, and he's, you know, he was over in Las Vegas last week winning an Open, and he's practically unbeatable. And I think if we could play darts, we'd win probably gold, silver, and bronze. But we haven't got a bad rugby team, so we might be able to scrape something there.
I gotta say, you've brought up the one sport in darts that may be a longer shot than Olympic golf.
Although if you speak to darts players, they will tell you that it's a proper sport, and they need, you know, they spend hours of training each day. You know, and it can't be easy to drink 12 pints and still maintain a steady throw. So all credit to them.
Sean Engel writes for The Guardian. He joined me on the line from London. Sean, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
After Stage 7 of the 2005 Tour de France, Lance Armstrong is the overall leader, enjoying a 55-second lead over Discovery Channel teammate George Hincapie. It's apparent from the omnipresent advertisements on the Tour de France course that there's big money to be made in pro cycling, a fact that many European companies have long recognized. And now there's one American company hoping to reap the benefits of a cycling team sponsorship. Reporter Sadie Babbitts is covering the Tour de France, and she has this report.
Liberty Seguros rider Luis Sanchez sprints off the time trial ramp at Fromentin, which hosted the start of this year's Tour de France. His sculpted legs move like pistons as he powers his way through last Saturday's 12-mile prologue. Sanchez is followed closely by the bright blue Liberty Seguros car as his coach Herminio Diaz Zapala yells into a handheld microphone. As Sanchez hits speeds upward of 30 miles an hour, Zapala watches nervously, his fidgety right hand picking at his trousers. There's a lot at stake. The performance of this young rider, team standings, then there's the American company, Liberty Mutual, which has invested millions of dollars in the team. Fabio Selvig, who directs the team sponsorships, says he too gets a bit anxious during the Tour de France.
I'm not racing, but I come into this with big expectations and realizing that a whole year on behalf of the whole organization is going to come down to these 3 weeks.
Liberty Seguros is the Spanish branch of Boston-based insurance company Liberty Mutual. 2 years ago, Liberty International chairman Tom Ramey was flipping through a Spanish cycling magazine and read that the number one Spanish team, ONCE, had lost its sponsorship. Ramey, an avid cyclist, says he saw an opportunity to raise the company's profile in Spain by supporting one of the most popular sports in Europe. Within a few days, an offer to ONCE was on the table, and after a five-hour meeting in Madrid, it was finished. Ramey says he'll never forget that meeting or the reaction to the five-year deal.
After we came out and all the photographers were there, and I realized, I mean, intellectually I knew that this was a big deal, but I had no idea that it was a celebrity kind of deal. I don't mean for us or for me, but for our company in Spain and for Spaniards in terms of their love of cycling.
Ramey won't say how much it costs Liberty Mutual to sponsor the Spanish team, but pro cycling sponsorships typically run into the millions. Since becoming the team's main sponsor, Liberty Seguros' brand recognition has skyrocketed from 20% last year to 50% this year. Ramey says the sponsorship was a risk worth taking.
The goodwill that was generated because we were the white knight that kept this team in Spain, and the success that the team has had since then, plus the way that we have used the team, all has proven to be far more successful than I ever imagined. You know, there's this law of unintended consequences. And my experience in the business world is that the law of unintended consequences, by and large, works against you. This is the first time I've had it just vastly exceed my expectations.
Outside the Liberty Seguros team bus, rider Luis Sanchez warms up on his bike before last Saturday's individual time trial. His legs spin into a blur as sweat drips from his face. Like all Liberty Seguros riders, he wears the company's logo, a white image of the Statue of Liberty across his blue jersey and on his shorts. That logo, along with the team buses and cars, will be seen by viewers around the world for all 3 weeks of the Tour de France. Team sponsorship director Fabio Selvig acknowledges that Liberty Seguros is a good marketing tool for Liberty Mutual, but he can't refrain from making a sports analogy.
There are a lot of similarities between the sport of cycling and the corporate culture at Liberty Mutual. There's a lot of teamwork in cycling. There's a lot of focusing on results and making sure that you're getting the job done properly. There's a lot of dedication and commitment, and it's beautiful to have not only a sport that helps you get the logos out there and get the brand awareness out there, but a sport that also embodies so much of what the company behind it is about.
So far, Liberty Seguros is looking strong in this year's Tour de France. Earlier this week in the team time trial, the group took fourth. The team's success this year isn't too surprising. It's home to two-time Vuelta a España rider Roberto Heras, who used to race with Lance Armstrong. Liberty Seguros also showcases rising young talent, including Alberto Contador and Luis Sanchez, who each draw comparisons to legendary Tour de France winner Miguel Indurain. Liberty Seguros hopes to make another strong showing in today's Stage 8, from Pforzheim to Gerdemer. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts in Nancy, France.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, tennis playing crustaceans return to the Athens of America. But first, how good a tennis player would Martina Navratilova have been if she hadn't had Chris Evert to chase? How good would Chris Evert have been if she hadn't been forced by Navratilova to start lifting weights and rushing the net? In The Rivals, subtitled Chris Evert versus Martina Navratilova, Their Epic Duels and Extraordinary Friendship, Jeanette Howard builds the case that both players were exceptionally fortunate in terms of their opposition. Jeanette Howard joins me now from New York City. Jeanette, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, my pleasure.
When you discussed this book with Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova, did they both think it was a good idea?
Yeah, actually, both of them thought it was a bit overdue, especially Martina, you know, opinionated as she is. She said, I wish this had been done 10, 15 years ago. They were both enthusiastic about the idea.
Maybe that's why she's kept playing, just waiting for this book.
Yeah. Well, she didn't say that, but I'm flattered that you think so.
One remarkable feature of the book is the extent to which Billie Jean King dominates the beginning of it. Is it possible to overstate her impact on tennis, women in general, and the perception of women in our culture?
No, I don't think so. I think without Billie, there would be no modern women's sports industry. Maybe somebody else would have come along, but it certainly would have different contours. I think she was a sort of woman of the moment, and there was, you know, women's sports was extraordinarily lucky that Martina and Chris came along just a few years afterwards and sort of continued all the arguments that Billie made.
When Evert and Navratilova began playing each other in 1973, Evert was, of course, the dominant player. But even after she had won 18 matches against Navratilova and only lost to her four times, you quote one tennis writer who says that Evert, quote, saw it coming. What exactly did she see coming at that point?
I think, you know, Billie Jean was the same about Chris, about Martina. When they looked at Martina, she just had this different sort of athleticism and different sort of imagination. Imagination is a word that's often used in golf to describe how players shape shots. But Martina had that from a young age, this sort of aggressive, you know, way of playing that's almost a leap of faith. It was totally contrary to the way women had played up until then. Even Billie Jean, who had the sort of ambition but not the same athleticism, you know, good as she was. And really, at the time Martina came along, a lot of people said that she, you know, played, quote, a man's style. It was that unusual for a woman to play the way she did.
Martina Navratilova's struggles have been well documented. She defected in 1975, leaving her family in Czechoslovakia. She was only 18 years old. She was regarded by some as a pariah and even a dangerous person when she acknowledged her sexual orientation. Was playing tennis the easiest part of her life?
I think so. And she has said that at times, that at the height of her, you know, unhappiness about, or her loneliness after she defected, the tennis court was the one place where nobody could get to her. None of the problems seemed to be on her mind. You know, there's an old line that the human brain can't think of two thoughts at the same time, and it's true. I think she found, like a lot of athletes, that the playing field of the games became someplace they could lose themselves.
Chris Evert, on the other hand, was perceived as having everything under control. This was her image. She certainly had a supportive family, but you write that some days Evert saw herself as, quote, a hamster on a wheel that was spinning too fast. What accounted for that dismay?
Well, I think that she started so young, and she was given this image that was humanly impossible to live up to, this pristine, squeaky clean, all-American girl image that was wonderful if you're a marketer, but if you're the person that it's been handed to, it doesn't allow you to be human. And I think when you're 16 or 18, you're just happy that people like you. But as you mature into a woman and you start to feel constrained by the image rather than flattered by it, I think it creates real problems. And you know, one of the things that was fascinating to me about doing the book was I think Chris makes an extraordinary migration during her life from this little girl that used to consciously think, what would Chris Evert do in this situation, to somebody, you know, who became really an opinionated and, you know, even political person, even though she's not really thought of that way.
Not only opinionated and political, but, you know, sometimes a little maybe outside the lines. I mean, this was a woman who was leaving notes with waiters saying, hey, tell that cute guy in the corner, this is my phone number, I hope he'll call.
Well, not just any cute guy, Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, exactly.
Who had just not so, you know, long before posed for a centerfold for Cosmopolitan magazine that was kind of, you know, a big, not a scandal, but, you know, very titillating. And you know, one of the most interesting quotes in the book to me is early, I think it's in the prologue, where Chris says she was always uncomfortable with this squeaky clean image. And the quote goes to the effect of, you know, I dated a lot of guys, I've told a lot of dirty jokes, I've cursed, I've been rude to my parents, I've lived a normal life. I think, you know, it's kind of reconciling that was one of the things she had to do her whole career.
Of the final in the 1985 French Open, which she lost, Martina Navratilova said of herself and her opponent, we brought out the best in each other. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that any great rivalry, the two rivals become inextricable from each other. I think that there's a kind of fundamental relationship that grows over time, that what one does, you know, intimately affects the other. And I think in their case, when you think of the extraordinary length of their rivalry, 16 years, they played 80 times, 60 of those were finals. And they both had that kind of diva thing where they just had this sense of themselves that couldn't permit them to be eclipsed by anyone, let alone each other. So there was this sort of friendship and also this kind of healthy amnesia when it came to, you know, being on the court and actually playing. They still wanted to beat each other's brains out.
You write of Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert, quote, the impact they had was revolutionary, but they were such different players and such different people. What was the revolution that they jointly provoked?
They made people reassess what they thought of, you know, the sort of totems that they represented. Chris had this sort of amazing ability to be all things for all people. You know, she was both the kind of flowering of this new feminist ideal, that, you know, the woman that could have it all. And yet she was also this antidote to the big mouth feminists of the time that were sort of agitating for better rights, better treatment in the workplace, all those things. And so Chris, I think, was given this sort of image of this delicate little, you know, girl next door who just happened to be good at tennis and proved over the course of her career to be this ruthless jock, that you could be both. And it was a very conscious decision. She says, I wanted both. I think the fact that Martina, you know, in her own way was revolutionary as far as the first person to dare to be openly gay that you can think of. I mean, Martina was the first lesbian that many people thought they knew. It just wasn't done then. And so you have them, I think, jointly. I don't think Martina would have ever gotten as humanized as she did if she had not had a great rival like Chris to play against. I don't know that people would have got past all the labels, you know, the communist defector, the lesbian outsider, the kind of, you know, muscled colossus that was nearly invincible for a few years. And I don't think Chris would have ever gotten the recognition as how good of an athlete she was and also what a compassionate person she was. I mean, everyone called her the Ice Maiden, but when Martina was outed in 1981, Chris Evert was one of her staunchest defenders, mm-hmm. And the same for Billie Jean King. So, you know, I think they both gave a sort of backdrop and made the traits of each other come out in greater relief.
John Ed Howard is the author of The Rivals, subtitled Chris Evert versus Martina Navratilova, Their Epic Duels and Extraordinary Friendship, published by Broadway Books. She joined me from New York. John Ed, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
On an April evening at the Longwood Cricket Club in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, once the home of various professional tennis tournaments and the site of a Davis Cup confrontation between the U.S. and Australia in 1999, one of the game's most influential forces was talking up a project that's been close to her heart since she invented it over 30 years ago. The force is Billie Jean King. The project is World Team Tennis, which returned to Boston this summer for the first time since 1978.
I think it's affordable family entertainment. I think it's another way to improve the quality of life in the community. I tell you, there's a huge reason for me, which is not very apparent, but when a child watches World Team Tennis or watch the Boston Lobsters play, they'll see men and women cooperating. And I think it sends out a very great message of how to help children be socialized. And that's one of the causes for me personally behind World Team Tennis, even though that's not what's going to sell it.
Though teams have arrived in and then vacated various cities over the past 30 years, King's original concept remains intact. In the WTT, men and women cheer each other as teammates, and mixed doubles is featured in each match. But it's significant that in April, when she spoke of the future of the Boston Lobsters' second coming, Billie Jean King alluded to marketing. The problem with World Team Tennis in its first Boston incarnation during the mid-70s was that nothing could sell it. The team had several owners over several years, and the last of them, Robert Kraft, who now owns the New England Patriots, bailed out after two summers. Kraft's successor after the long hiatus is Bahar Utam, a self-confessed tennis nut with money to lose should that prove to be unavoidable. Bahar Utam was initially attracted to World Team Tennis because at its matches, fans like him weren't constantly told to be quiet.
This is fun, crowd participation, interaction with the players. It's really, you know, when I went around looking at the other venues before I made a decision to bring the franchise here, I saw that, and it was very attractive to see the belonging, really. You know, this is my team, and the other team, boo them, and this is our team, cheer them, you know. So that's fun. It's fun.
The fun theme was evident when the Lobsters opened their season on Tuesday night against the Kansas City Explorers. Bahar Utam met and greeted various supporters in a tent outside Bright Arena, the hockey rink at Harvard University, which has been converted into a tennis venue for the month of July. Bands played, large red foam lobster claws were distributed freely, clam chowder flowed, and some of the Lobsters' players circulated among the guests. Kristen Schlukebier, who is still knocking at the door of the top-tier women's tour and who would play women's doubles and mixed doubles that evening, agreed with the team's owner that the main difference between playing on the tour and playing for the Lobsters was that the latter gig is more fun.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, you have a better shot at, you know, like say there's a lob over someone's head. I mean, they're going to try for a between-the-leg shot rather than, like, you know, the high percentage shot, just for fun and, you know, to show these people, you know, what you can do and give them a little bit of entertainment for the night. Yeah, I mean, it's still competitive, but like I said before, it's a fun thing as well.
Last July, Kristen Schlukebier had her fun playing for the Lasers, the WTT team in Springfield, Missouri. But in the most recent draft, Kristen's former club decided to go big time.
They tried to protect me this year, but they wanted a marquee player, and they got Lindsay Davenport, so they couldn't protect me, so Boston snatched me up. So we'll see where I go next year.
Tennis, as the WTT plays it, is designed to move right along. Each match consists of five sets, one men's singles, one women's singles, one men's doubles, one women's doubles, and one mixed doubles. The first player or doubles team to win five games wins the set. Each game counts toward the final team score, meaning that it's a lot better to lose 5-4 than 5-0 and that matches are likely to be in doubt until the mixed doubles confrontation at the end of the evening. Beyond that, serves that hit the net and bounce in are good, making the let obsolete, and a coach can dispute a call by tossing an orange towel onto the court, thereby initiating an instant replay-type consultation with an electronic device called Hawkeye. Ties are resolved by tiebreakers, and a tied tiebreaker culminates in a super tiebreaker, but more about that mystery later. On Tuesday night, the action began with men's doubles, in which Brian McPhee and David McPherson of the Explorers slipped by Thomas Blake and Johan Landsberg of the Lobsters 5-3. In the owner's box, Bahar Utam gamely demonstrated that it really was okay to cheer.
Let's go, Lobsters! Let's go, Lobsters!
Early in the match, it became evident that people sitting in the boxes at each end of the court better pay attention whether or not they were enjoying the tennis when serves too well placed to be returned began bouncing off the heads of the spectators. Even veteran tennis columnist and commentator Bud Collins wondered out loud about the seat he'd been given beside the owner.
I'm not sure Mahar's doing us a favor.
That's fine.
When one cannonball serve by Tommy Blake glanced off the edge of Brian McPhee's racket and ricocheted into the cheap seats, a young man there nonchalantly snatched the yellow ball out of the air before it could conk his date in the coconut, then gallantly flipped it to her for a souvenir. The young woman, whose name was Carly, acknowledged her companion's heroics.
I was fearing for my life, and he's a hero.
I came to the rescue.
He's a real hero. I'm going to buy him the biggest steak of his life tonight.
The marquee player for the Lobsters is Martina Navratilova, who is scheduled to play in only 2 of the team's 7 home matches. But the hero on Tuesday night was Kristin Schlukebier, who led the Lobsters to a 5-2 triumph in women's doubles and then kept the mixed doubles team in contention through an extraordinarily close match that made necessary first the tiebreaker and then the aforementioned super tiebreaker. A phenomenon that most of the people in the building did not appear to understand. I turned to Mr. Tennis, Bud Collins, but he wasn't much help.
This is the first super tiebreaker I've ever witnessed. Now they've thrown a coin. It's safe to say that one team or the other will win.
As usual, Bud was right. One team or the other did. Unhappily for Bahar Utam and the Boston crowd, it was the Kansas City Explorers. When everyone had finally come to understand that's what had happened, I asked Lobsters coach Ann Smith, who played for the Lobsters 30 years ago, if world team tennis matches were always this close.
I think when I played, I think we might have had one super tiebreaker the whole time, so this is incredible that it literally did come down to one point.
If spectators in Hartford, New York, St. Louis, Sacramento, Houston, and the 7 other cities where world team tennis is presently playing can't expect each match to come down to the last shot, they can look forward to entertaining team tennis. But if you want to count yourself among that number, don't blink. The WTT regular season is crammed into less than 3 weeks. Tonight, the Foxfire will square off against the New York Buzz in Hartford, and the New York Sport Times will visit the Aces in St. Louis. In tomorrow's action, the Sacramento Capitals will host the Philadelphia Freedom. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a gentle grammatical lesson from a not-so-gentle listener. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Wednesday, the IOC awarded, if that's the proper term, the 2012 Summer Games to London, and then London was bombed. The celebration of the awarding of the Olympics obviously was curtailed. Will we see long-term effects?
They have obviously 7 years to ratchet up the security on the event. And as we know, a lot can happen in 7 years. It was really quite poignant to see the London bid team, who, of course, were still in Singapore at the time, react to the awful events of the next day. And I went to the 1996 ones in Atlanta a week after the bombing of the Atlanta Olympic Park. And obviously the security was present there, but not to the extent, I'm sure, that will be in London in 2012, or for that matter, in Beijing the next time around.
Beyond security, an obvious concern, what do you think about London as a venue? You're a veteran of Seoul and L.A., Olympics held there.
Well, I mean, I am in favor of any Olympic venue that can be fairly described as not here.
So, not in the United
exactly
States or
right.
Not in Boston.
Not in Boston. I will expand a little bit to not in the United States, but I guess all praise go to Lordship Seb Coe, who was the one when you come right down to it, there is very little that the International Olympic Committee won't do for an Olympic gold medalist, and especially an articulate one. Seb Coe's a member of parliament. Seb Coe swings a lot of weight with what is, to me, laughingly called the Olympic movement, and I think that may have been the thing that swung the vote.
On Friday, the IOC secretly voted to oust baseball and softball after the 2008 games in Beijing. Given the utter dominance of the U.S. softball team, I can understand the motivation for eliminating that sport. But baseball? Why?
Well, because the Major League players have declined to participate, and without the star power, there aren't enough baseball powers in the world either. In case you're wondering, Bill, the replacement sports will be something along the lines of either golf, no, rugby, yes. Squash, I don't care. Fine if you want it. Karate, I guess you've got taekwondo. There's no reason why you can't have karate. And roller sports. Hey, everybody skate! Ladies
now.
Only.
If it's golf, do the PGA and LPGA players go?
Some of them will, I'm sure. I mean, I can imagine that Nike might suggest to Mr. Woods that
worldwide exposure might not be a bad idea.
Perhaps worldwide exposure and an Olympic gold medal. I do remember in 1988 in Seoul was the year Steffi Graf won the Grand Slam in women's tennis. And she also won the Olympic gold medal. And she looked happier at winning that than she did winning any of the four Grand Slam titles. I'm sort of rooting for rugby.
The Tour de France continues to be the Tour de Lance, or Lance, as they so provincially put it in the United States. There was some excitement on Wednesday when Lance Armstrong said that he didn't want to wear the yellow jersey, but the sponsors put him right on that.
Yeah, he was going to forfeit the yellow jersey because David Zabriskie hit a barricade in the last moments of the team time trial. Armstrong went off in his Discovery Channel uniform, and the race officials told him, I don't care how many times you've won this thing, you can win this thing 50 times, and you probably will. You still have to wear La Meilleure Jean because otherwise we'll just have a hissy fit all over the Pyrenees.
The All-Star Game is nearly upon us, and so sports fans everywhere are talking about Swin Cash, Sue Bird, Tamika Catchings, and Lauren Jackson, aren't they?
Of course, because the WNBA All-Star Game is coming up. In the Western Conference, which you declined to mention, by the way, your starters are Cheryl Swopes, Lauren Jackson, Yolanda Griffith, Sue Bird, and Diana Taurasi. And the leading reserve on the Western Conference All-Stars from the Los Angeles Sparks? Shamiqua Holmes.
Only a reserve, but she could be the star. On Tuesday night, Major League Baseball will stage the other All-Star game. What baseball-related matters are you eager to discuss at the season's approximate halfway point?
Oh, your defending world champion Boston Red Sox are in complete yappery turmoil. They're going to bring Curt Schilling back and try to make him a short reliever and a closer. This has come under some criticism by All-Star starter Johnny Damon, who says that Mike Timlin should be the closer. They're yelling at each other. There's still three games up on the Orioles. Life is still good, and life is still noisy. But I think that without question, for me, the two great stories in baseball this year are the competitive success of the Washington franchise, who go into the All-Star break leading the Braves in the National League East, and the tremendous performance by the Chicago White Sox, who have run away and hidden from the rest of the landfill that is the American League Central.
We've reached that magical portion of the sports calendar called the NBA free agency period.
Ho-ho!
Have there been any transactions of interest?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about the free agency season so far is that the consensus was that one of the big players in free agency would be the Cleveland Cavaliers in their attempt to find a shooting guard to play alongside LeBron James to ease the offensive load on him. The first person they wanted was Ray Allen. He re-signed with Seattle. The second person they want, and the one they thought they could get, was Michael Redd from the Milwaukee Bucks, but he's re-signed there. So I think the most interesting thing about the NBA free agency is that LeBron James is not getting the help he needs in Cleveland.
A few weeks ago, while attending a Pittsburgh Pirates game, Doug Rohrkast caught, picked up, or otherwise accumulated 3 baseballs within 15 minutes. And this seemed to me a remarkable achievement until I received from a Boston baseball fan the email which I now submit to you as Exhibit A, that souvenir distribution at Major League Baseball games is not fair because I've never gotten any.
Ah, but our friend John Plout writes us that he's got four.
In a game
that David Wells pitched for the Red Sox against the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, this is a weird record because I remember being at Tiger Stadium during the last desperate days of the Tigers playing at Tiger Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
You could have gotten 12 foul balls.
Nobody even chased them. There were
15 people in the stands. I think we should have a sellout and non-sellout category for this.
Probably should be 2 categories. And finally, Charlie.
Ah, this is my favorite one.
Is Estonia's luck on wife carrying as impressive as, say, the dominance of China in diving or the U.S. in Olympic softball?
This is remarkable. 40 couples from 10 countries went to the Finnish village of Sonkajärvi. Thank you very much. To complete the 253.5-meter-long obstacle course, a man must carry a woman, not necessarily his spouse, through a pool and across hurdles. And Margo Usorg, who is the man in the couple, against all odds, completed the course with his friend Eagle Saul, who is the woman, against all odds, in 59 seconds, but using the classic Estonian carry, which is, Bill, hanging upside down with her legs clenched around his neck.
It's a family show. Charlie Pierce employs the Irish wife carrying technique and writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, as well as joining me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Sonkajärvi yourself, pal.
My favorite letter this week came from Sankar Swaminathan, who wrote to ask if the Tim Kirkchin he hears talking about baseball on Only a Game is the same Tim Kirkchin who played basketball for Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland 30 years ago.
We laugh about my predictions and how often I'm wrong, and that's the best part about it.
Come on, Mr. Swaminathan. Does that sound like somebody who was in high school 30 years ago? Keith Tilcher, who hears Only a Game on WFSU in Tallahassee, enjoyed my story in last week's program about the baseball games I used to create and announce even more than 30 years ago using a tennis ball bouncing off a garage. The story brought back the fondest of memories and a tear to my eye, Mr. Tilcher wrote. Growing up in South Florida, a backyard shed provided me the same opportunities for imaginary games. However, for me, the Giants never won. The Dodgers were always the better team, thanks to my Brooklyn-born father's influence. Thanks for the memory and for a great show. Joan Harvey, who wrote to say that she, too, enjoyed that story, indicated that her late husband played the same sort of game when he was growing up in Massachusetts. Maybe we all should have gotten together and started a league. Joyce Chuchian-Ferranti wrote this week to report that her 9-year-old son had written a short poem that ended, quote, "The players talk trash so much all day, that's what I know about the NBA. He even colored a picture to go with it, Ms. Chuchian-Ferranti wrote, two players with a referee holding back one of them. One, quote, balloon said, bleep. The other player's balloon said, what? Whatever happened to the simple game of basketball and simple idols? Karen Given's story about soaring in last week's program provoked Mary T. Johnson to write, quote, I winced to hear the reporter say, if it was. I believe the correct construction is, if it were. I expect more from public radio personnel. Your listeners count on your fine reports as well as your example of English competence, a welcome change from the usual radio fare. Should you have a comment, a correction, or a suggestion, our address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. On Monday, while many were preparing afternoon barbecues for the 4th of July, Swedish adventurer Renata Schlumska paddled across Puget Sound to begin a journey that's expected to keep her busy for the next 478 days. Ms. Schlumska is attempting to become the first person to circumnavigate the contiguous United States using only a kayak, a bicycle, and inline skates. Renata Schlumska joins me from her fourth stop on that adventure. Renata, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi. So nice that I could come along.
It's very nice for us. First of all, tell me where you stopped for the night last night and what your accommodations were like.
Well, I stopped east of Port Angeles, and I slept in my tent, Find a nice green spot here close to the water because my kayak is quite heavy, so I don't want to have to pull it too far. So I was camping out.
Obviously, for an adventure like this, you must have a cook, a masseuse, a couple of support vehicles along, right?
I wish. If I would have had that, I would have done this in a couple of months. But the idea is actually to try and do it by my own strength and by my own means as much as possible. But if I sometime come to a nice resort that's close to the water, I might take a stop there and get a massage and a good cooked meal too.
It sounds to me like you would deserve it above all people. Can you describe the route that you plan to take over the next 474 days or so?
Of course. Right now I'm heading out for the west coast, and once I hit the coast, I'm going to follow the coastline all the way from Washington State, past Oregon and along California down to San Diego. Mm-hmm. In San Diego, I pick up my bike, and then I will bike along the Mexican border, paddle a small stretch of the Rio Grande, and then get down to the Mexican Gulf, paddle around the Gulf, around Florida, down to the Keys,
Then
start hitting north again along the East Coast, all the way up to Maine, and then back again westward along the Canadian border, through the Great Lakes, Minnesota, North Dakota, and across the Rockies and back to Seattle. Kind of short description.
Yeah, kind of a short description of a very long trip. How does your kayak get from the place where you take it out of the water to get on your bike to the place where you have to go back into the water?
Well, that took me some time to figure out, and I decided that I want to have it with me the entire way so that I myself can decide when I want to paddle or when I want to bike or when I want to inline skate, which also is one of the ways I travel by inline skate. So I actually have a small trailer and that fits inside the kayak, so I can pull the kayak behind me either on my bike or on my inline skates.
Oh my gosh.
It's quite heavy though.
In the realm of endurance adventuring, there are lots of challenges that nobody's ever tried, or maybe they've tried and not completed them. Why this particular attempt, this particular project?
Well, this is a project that kind of was born of almost 4 years ago with my fiancé, Joran Kropp. We had been going to the Himalayas a couple of seasons and kind of wanted to do something different. And we had been in the States and in the Washington area, and we liked it very much. So we started thinking about what could we do here. And then, of course, it kind of grew. Why stop with the West Coast if you can continue, and then the Rio Grande and the Intracoastal Waterway? So this felt like a great project. And then, of course, I've been had to adjust it a bit to be a one-man expedition since Joran passed away 3 years ago now in September. So
I've read that you want to inspire others to try outdoor adventuring, but a lot of American couch potatoes, you know, to kayak or bike 23 miles a week would be a stretch. What will the average person learn from your adventure?
Well, I kind of hope that, I mean, I'm doing this mostly for, because I love the outdoors. I like to be in the nature. And just yesterday I saw eagles, I saw seals, I saw sea otters, and that just makes me so happy to see all the wildlife. And if I, during this trip, can inspire somebody to start being a bit more active and maybe look at me, like I've looked at other adventurers and think, oh my God, they can climb Mount Everest or they can bike this and this distance, then maybe I can actually do something smaller. Everything is possible. You just have to make up your mind. It's not always easy, but people have much more strength than they realize. That's what I believe.
Renata Schlumska is roughly 50 or 60 miles into her 11,000-mile trek around the contiguous United States. We hope to meet up with her again when she reaches Boston in May. Renata, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help from Eugene Levy at Splash Studios in New York. Special thanks to Mike Toda. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about the Rivals, browse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Boston Lobster's owner, Bahar Utam, who has the following wish for World Team tennis fans.
We want them to scream. We want them to shout. We want them to belong to the team.
Was Bahar Utam a member of the Isley Brothers? I'll have to look that up. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.